Thank you. Well, Roger, thank you so very much for a beautifully fluent, vibrant, fantastically illustrated and truly inspiring lecture. A real pleasure to listen to you. Now, we have about 20 minutes or so for questions. Just a couple of things to say before we go into questions. I'm sure there'll be many for Roger. That this is being recorded, and therefore it's very important that we hear the questions. There are static microphones in the middle here and up the sides, and if you can get to a microphone, please go to one. Just press the little yellow button once, and then speak into the microphone, although not too close, otherwise you get that horrible distortion noise. If you can't get to a microphone, we have at least two. There's one here and one somewhere. We've got two up the back. We've got two roving microphones. So if you can't quite reach a microphone, not to worry at all. So I do suspect there will be lots of perhaps just either walk to a microphone or raise your hand, and I shall try and keep an eye out. Perhaps just to start us off while you're thinking, Roger, the concept of two different types of patients of Parkinson's. I'm sure there'll be lots of people in the audience thinking, which one am I? And the doctors amongst them thinking, gosh, how do we spot? Is it relatively straightforward to sort of dichotomise patients like that? Or
Yes, I mean, based on the study we did, the campaign study, the best predictors of people who were doing badly, if you like, was that we did a whole battery of tests on patients, but essentially on our sample, if you were over 72 years old when you presented, you couldn't list more than 20 animals in 90 seconds, and you couldn't draw interlocking pentagons, which some of you may have done on a thing called the mini mental state examination, then those three parameters gave you a probability of having a major thinking problem, a dementia in 5 years, which was 88-fold greater than if you were younger and you could do both of those tests. So my interpretation of that is that those subtle thinking tests are actually the very earliest features of the dementia in Parkinson's. Now, you may say, well, that's a bit sad and that's a bit depressing, but for me, it's changed my clinical practice, because when I see people in clinic newly diagnosed, if they cannot do those tests, then I will not waste time trying them on, you know, dopamine agonists or trying this or that. I go straight for aggressive treatment to get better control of their motor features. I go early for cholinesterase inhibitors because I know these patients are going to have a difficult time. So you want to give them as good a time as you can whilst you have the most impact with the drugs that you can use.
And patients in the more benign group, those might be ones where you're looking at selegiline and dopamine agonists, perhaps, and a less aggressive approach.
Yeah, I would agree. I think you use a less aggressive approach. And if I'm honest, my view on Parkinson's is probably very different to everybody else's in many ways, because if I was allowed to do what I wanted to do, I would be much more aggressive in those early patients in terms of invasive therapies. So my vision is that when people present with Parkinson's disease, young onset Parkinson's disease, I would leave them for a year or two with, as you say, selegiline and drugs of that nature. Mm-hmm. I would then advocate that if we have a readily available cell-based therapy, we should give it to patients at that stage, because if you put 100,000 dopamine cells into their brain at that point, they would not require any drug treatment for 5, 10, 15 years. You avoid all the costs and complication of drug therapies. Patients do perfectly well. And, you know, you may say, well, that's not feasible, but in the health service, from a cost-effective point of view, they would actually think that's cost-effective. So I think going early with more aggressive therapies may be the future of Parkinson's in that group of slightly younger patients.
Yeah, Tyler.
Just to touch on costs, so how much do you estimate cell transplantation therapy would cost the NHS to perform per patient?
Yeah, well, it depends who's providing you with the cells. That's the critical question. So one of the problems with cell-based therapies is if you use fetal dopamine cells, I mean, the trial we're doing, it will cost about €25,000 to do a transplant in a patient, and then with the surgical costs and the immunotherapy. So about £18,000-£20,000. And if it works, then you won't need anything else thereafter. Deep brain stimulation costs about £25,000, I think, and you have to replace the battery every few years, which is a few thousand pounds. The more aggressive therapies like apomorphine infusions are $10,000-$12,000 a year. Duodopa, which some people have directly into the bowel, is $35,000-$40,000 a year. So they are relatively cheap if you use fetal dopamine cells. The problem will come, and I think, you know, you raise a very important point here, which I've never talked about before, which is if you go for an embryonic stem cell line, then if someone owns that line, you know, a company has it, then, you know, what are the company going to charge? Now, the European Parliament have said that you cannot patent embryonic stem cells. So this has, you may think, well, this is a good thing because now no company can own it. The problem is, you know, will people fund ES work when you can't actually protect any of the intellectual property to do with it? So it's an interesting area where that will go.
Yes, lady here.
To ask on an earlier stage, from a medical point of view, you were saying that you could test to find out Lewy bodies. Now, in the World Congress, they were speaking about testing for Lewy bodies. Is there any logistical way that within the population as a whole that this can be done?
Yeah, it's a very good question because so whether you could screen people, So some people have tried to do this. So what you could say is you can go out and you can just say, well, I'm going to start off by screening people for sense of smell, and I will have a questionnaire on some of the features to do with sleeping. And if you have an absence of smell and a positive questionnaire for sleep, then we will take things further. And that may involve a bowel biopsy to see whether one has alpha-synuclein within it. So one could start to screen people to see whether they are at high risk of developing Parkinson's disease. Now, the argument would be, well, that is all well and good, but what are we going to do with that piece of information? In the absence of any preventative therapy, why would people want to know that they're likely to get Parkinson's when we can't do anything about it? Now, I think that you know, things are changing. I think disease protection, drugs which may protect, may be coming along, and going earlier may be a good thing to do. But until such time as there's something that's clearly neuroprotective, I don't think that people are going to be keen on screening patients for it.